One thing that makes me envious of children today is the way they're taught history at school. I don't know what your memory of history is, of history lessons. If it's anything like mine, history was just a summary of kings, queens, dates and battles with very little sense at all of what life was actually like for the ordinary citizen at any particular period of time. To this day, I can still remember a spurious telephone number that I was taught by my history teacher at primary school. The spurious telephone number was Brom 4689. Phone numbers in those days had letters as well as numbers. It shows my age, I suppose. Brom 4689 has stayed with me ever since. What is the significance of Brom 4689? It means I can tell you the dates of four major battles at the beginning of the 18th century. B-R-O-M, the battles of Blenheim in 1704, of Ramillies in 1706, of Oudenarde in 1708, and Malplaquet in 1709. There you are. But as for who fought in them, who won, and why any of them made any difference to anything at all, is a complete mystery to me. Just a list of names and dates. And it's stuck in the head, and I'm frankly not much the wiser, whereas modern youngsters, in this regard at least, are better served. Bible history is different yet again, certainly in the Old Testament, as in the books of Samuel and Kings. Now, last week we were looking at chapter 3, and the call of Samuel, the young boy, to be God's prophet, his spokesman to his people. And in the very beginning of chapter 4, Samuel disappears. We read there that the word of Samuel came to all Israel, and that's the last we hear of him until chapter 7, when he calls on the people to return to the Lord with all their heart. And there is a 20-year gap between the beginning of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 7. And that is typical of Bible history. Huge sweeps of history are covered in just a few paragraphs. We know next to nothing about what happened in Israel over those 20 years. The writer just doesn't tell us. And he chooses instead, and this is typical, to focus on one particular event and the lasting consequences of that event. In other words, his writing is deliberately selective. It's sometimes called prophetic history. It is history writing with a purpose. And disproportionate space is given to one single episode in the experience of Israel. And the reason for that is that the lessons learnt from that episode are of timeless significance. They are as instructive and as vitally important to you and me in Tunbridge Wells in 2018 as they were some 3,000 years ago when the things recorded here actually took place. And that's what Paul means when he writes to the church at Corinth. Whatever was written down in former days, in other words, a narrative like this, was written down for our instruction, to learn from us on whom the end times have come. Now, much of Old Testament history is, in fact, about battles, and it is battles with the Philistines that are frequently the issue in the books of Samuel, which date from about 1,000 years before Christ. The Philistines lived in the direction of what we know as the Gaza Strip to the southwest of the land. The Israelites themselves are found further in, north and south, and relations between Israel and Philistines are seldom friendly. They're hostile, and that's no surprise, therefore, to read in verse 1 of chapter 4 that Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. Nothing new in that. And we read on. They encamped at Ebenezer. The Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines. So that's the first thing we learn in this narrative, that the battle is lost. The battle is lost. The mere fact has told us Israel was defeated, and 4,000 men are slain on the battlefield. And news from the field reaches the elders of the people, who go on to ask in verse 3, "Why has the Lord defeated us today?" Not the question that people generally ask after a battle. We might have expected them to say, "How came the Philistines won?" They don't ask that. They say, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" Now, these are the people of God. They are his chosen people, and they have a very good understanding of his sovereign control of all things, which is why they put the question that way. That is axiomatic to Bible believers. And of course, it's reaffirmed by Jesus, who says, "Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And yet not one of them falls to the ground without the will of your heavenly Father." And a superficial belief in God will attribute the good things in life to him, but the less good and the bad to some other force or even some other deity. Certainly the surrounding tribes at the time would have thought like that, but not so the elders of Israel. If defeat has been their experience, the right question is, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? And that is a good question, then as now, for a believer to ask when things are difficult. Then if you know Psalm 139 is one of the loveliest of the Psalms of David. In it he marvels at the intimacy of God's knowledge of him, how God's eye has been on him from before his birth, how God has knit him together in his mother's womb. What a lovely phrase. Think of little Jacob, knit together in his mother's womb. And David is overwhelmed by the beauty of God's ways, and he celebrates them as he goes through his psalm. And at the very end, he's so conscious of God's goodness that he cannot bear the fact of wickedness in God's world and of wicked people. And he says he loathes those who rise up against the Lord. He even calls for their abolition from the face of the earth. But having said that, he then turns the spotlight on himself and his own heart and its potential for just the same wickedness which he hates in others. And he concludes, not with thoughts about them and the wicked, but with his own heart. And he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way." That is the right attitude at any time for a Christian. Search me, O God. Deal with me. See if there is any wicked way lurking in me. Help me to resist it, to fight it, to drive it away in your power. That's always a good attitude to take every day, but it's maybe one that should be redoubled when life does not go as we might have expected. It is good to pray all the more, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Teach me your way, that I may walk in your truth." Well, the elders do well to ask this question then, why has the Lord defeated us? But it's not followed by any of that sort of searching of the heart. It's quite absent, and that is their mistake. The question is no sooner asked than they've answered it. Why has the Lord defeated us today? Oh, it must be because we forgot to bring the ark along with us. That must be the reason. Of course, stupid of us. We couldn't expect to win without the ark. What is this ark? Well, it's not Noah's ark. Can we just deal with that one? Nothing to do with that. This is the Ark of the Covenant, the covenant box, a wooden box covered in gold, 3¾ feet long, 2¼ feet wide and high. And it contained within it, among other things, a copy of the Ten Commandments, of the law that God had graciously given to his people. There are other things there as well, but that is the ark. And it usually sat behind a thick curtain in Israel's worship center in a spot called the Holy Place. And in verse 4, we discover it described as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. The cherubim are sort of superhuman creatures, and the word there is enthroned. The ark represents the rule of God, among other things, among his people. And we read of it elsewhere, leading the people into battle. The ark is almost personified in the days of Moses. When the ark sets out, then the people follow. When the ark returns, the people come back. Of course, it doesn't set out on its own. They carry it. But it becomes so symbolic of the presence of God with his people that it can almost be described as if it's got a life of its own. It sets out. It comes back. But that's where the danger lies, because the sign of God's presence has here become more important than the actual presence of God. And that can happen all too easily. When I was working in North London a number of years ago, we used to meet with the local clergy once a month. It was a rather depressing experience usually, because the local clergy were depressed. And we were all sat around together, most of us sharing our depressions. One or two bright sparks have more positive things to say, but it was not, frankly, the happiest of gatherings. Moan, grumble. And the topic, one day, we were asked to bring signs of hope in our parishes. Well, I remember, well, as soon as the question was asked, one sort of middle-aged chap said, "None at all in mine. No hope at all. Nothing to be glad about. But I celebrate the Eucharist every day. So we keep going." And there we are. The symbol of God's presence is there. but actually no hope. And how easily the symbol can replace the reality. And that is what's happened here. And we see in verse 3, there's a giveaway phrase. You see, let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us. It. But it can't do anything. At the end of the day, it is just a box. However attractive, however sacred, however powerful its symbolism, it is just a box. It cannot do anything. It is the Lord that they need. But they seem to have forgotten this. And then the ark arrives, verse 5, and there's a great shout. All Israel gave a mighty shout. Yay, we'll be okay now. And the Philistines hear it and they say, help, what's that shout from the enemy camp? And they've got some sort of confused awareness that Israel's God can be a bit of a problem. And they say, well, we just have to fight harder then. Be men and fight. And they do, and they win. And we read in verse 10, the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated. And they fled every man to his own home. So the score has gone up. Philistines 2, Israel 0. And this victory is bigger by far than the earlier one. Not just 4,000, but 30,000 slain on the field. What has gone wrong with God's people here? What is the problem? The problem is there's no longer any fear of God among the people. The book of Proverbs tells us that it is the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of wisdom. And to fear God means to recognize his greatness, his goodness, his otherness, his holiness, in other words. And to recognize that beside that, you are very small and very weak and very sinful and very corrupt. And to fear God is to take him seriously, to be humble, to be reverent before him. It's the opposite of presumption, of presuming on his kindness and his favor, on looking on him as an equal, or even worse, as a servant. Which is almost where they've got to, isn't it? We're in trouble, so God will have to come and help us out. We're in charge, and he'll have to do what we want. The Philistines are against us. We need to beat them. God must help us. And if we bring the ark in, he'll have to help us. I mean, imagine how stupid he will look if he doesn't help us at that point. One commentator talks about how his elder brother, when a teenager, used to treat his dad rather the way the Israelites are treating the Lord at this point. His older brother would arrange a date with his girlfriend, and then they'd both get it in their diaries, and he would then tell his dad that he needed the car at that time, which was kind of blackmail, because if he were then unable to keep the date because his dad wouldn't lend him the car, then he and his girlfriend would both agree that dad is downright mean. And dad wasn't one to be thought of as being downright mean, so he'll have to lend the car, won't he? And there's some similar sort of thinking here in Israel. They think they can twist his arm. God will look like a loser if he doesn't help. And what God wants to look like a loser? And what they discover to their horror is that God is actually quite willing to look like a loser if that is the way to bring them back to their senses and to get a relationship back on a proper footing. Because that, the quality of relationship between him and his people, is what matters to him. His desire for his people is that they should be holy, just as he is holy. Now, the ark isn't just the ark. It is referred to all the time as the ark of the covenant. That is emphasized all along. Verse 3, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Verse 4, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Verse 5, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Why so? Because a covenant is an agreement between two parties. And God's relationship with his people is based on covenant. That is the relationship in which he's entered into them and with them in the first place. And the great statement of the covenant is, I will be your God, and you will be my people, and you will be holy as I am holy. And that hasn't changed. That is still how God relates to his people today in the new covenant established through Jesus Christ and his death and his rising again. God says to us, to his people today, as he said to them then, you shall be holy because I am holy. But Israel has lost sight of this. And that's very plain, because who is it who brings the ark from Shiloh at the request of the elders into the battle? Well, they're there at the end of verse 4. It is the two sons of Eli who bring the ark of the covenant. And what do we know about them? We know they are contemptuous of the things of God. They're greedy, they're immoral, they're dissolute. They think nothing of sleeping with women at the very entrance of the place of worship. And the elders don't seem to mind. They don't care anymore about that. They're happy for Hophni and Phinehas to bring in this most special covenant box, because to them the box is what matters. The immorality of the people carrying it is an irrelevance. Now that is tragic. The fear of the Lord is no longer there among the people. And you know, Christian churches, whether local or denominational, can go the same way. The first century church at Corinth went that way. We read in 1 Corinthians that a church member was having an affair with his mother-in-law, and nobody thought it odd at all. Nobody batted an eyelid. And sexual immorality has no place among God's people. And for it to be affirmed by the leaders of a church or a denomination is to invite God's hand of judgment, as the elders of Israel find in what happens. So the battle is lost. That's the first thing. But there is worse to come, because not only is the battle lost, but the ark is lost too. That's the second thing. We read at verse 11, the ark of God was captured. Losing battles is bad enough. Losing the ark is catastrophic. And that's where we meet Eli again. We met him last week in the temple. He was helping young Samuel to recognize and respond to the voice of God. This time he's sitting on his own by the road outside Shiloh. We may wonder why he's there. Well, he has watched the ark being carried off to battle by his sons. And godly man that he is, he fears for the outcome. He doesn't share the confidence of others. He's not at all persuaded. He can see that this attitude of bring the ark in is sheer superstition. He's old at 98. He's virtually blind. He trembles as he waits for the news. What is it that worries him? He trembles, verse 13, for the ark of God. Well, news comes to the city, first of all, about the defeat. The whole city cries out. Eli wants to know what the cry is about. And he's told, he receives three verbal blows to the head. First blow, the Philistines have won. Second blow, your sons are dead. Third blow, the ark is captured. He seems to survive blows one and two, but blow three is too much. He topples over and breaks his neck and is gone. Because for Israel, to lose the ark is to lose everything. The unthinkable has happened. It announces to a watching world that the God of Israel is a loser, that he can't defend his own interests, his own land, or his own people. And if he is lost, what hope, what future can there be for the nation? The ark, you may see, meant so much. God gave it to them, and it represented his rule. We've seen that. His revelation in the Ten Commandments, making himself known to them. His reconciliation, because every year sprinkled blood would be put on the ark as a sign of his peace and his peacemaking with his people. You see, the ark says, this God rules. This God communicates. This God loves to forgive. But that ark is gone. And Eli's death is quickly followed by that of his daughter-in-law. Phinehas has a wife who is there. She hears the news and she dies in childbirth. And the birth of her own son gives her no joy. She calls him Ichabod, meaning God's glory has departed. And this son, she declares, is born into a world in which he has no future, because the glory of God has departed from Israel. That's how verse chapter 4 finishes. She says, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured. Well, she's right, and yet she's not quite right. Because to her way of thinking, the glory of God is in the box. And as the box goes off, the glory goes with it. But actually, he is already gone. By the time the ark is taken, the glory is long since gone, and the disappearance of the ark is just the evidence that God himself is no longer there with his people. And if we think that's just an Old Testament problem, we should remember the words of Jesus to the seven churches in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. Spiritual complacency is no less a danger today than it was then. And in the vision of John, the risen Jesus walks among the seven lampstands which represent the seven churches. And to each in turn he says, I know your works. Nothing escapes his gaze. And to the church at Ephesus, where love has gone cold, he says, remember from what you have fallen, or I will come and remove the lampstand from your place, from its place. It is sobering to read that the only churches of those seven that are commended unreservedly are the small and struggling ones, which others might be tempted to despise. So the battle is lost. That's bad news. The ark is lost. That is catastrophic news. But now we learn that though the battle and the ark may be lost, God's cause is never lost. He wins every time, even when he appears to have lost, which the story of the house of Dagon in chapter 5 makes wonderfully plain. This is one of the great stories, isn't it, of the Old Testament. The Philistines worship Dagon, their god, and Dagon clearly has the upper hand, and he's shown himself in every way to be superior to the God of Israel. The ark has been captured. And so when the Philistines capture the ark, the obvious thing to do is to put it in Dagon's house. And that's what they do. Verse 2, the Philistines take the ark of God and they bring it into the house of Dagon and they set it up beside Dagon. Doesn't that have an amazingly contemporary ring? One god next to the next god. Dagon is quite happy to share his seat with this newcomer. He doesn't make exclusive claims for himself and he wouldn't want anyone else to either. And the Philistine attitude is, gather as many gods as you can find. Put them all in next to each other. They're all much of a muchness. Nice for them to get to know each other. They'll become friends. They'll be happy that way. And so the Philistines put this new god, as it were, next to their own. And they think no more about it. They retire for the night. Next morning they go in to pay their respects to Dagon. And something very surprising has happened. Dagon isn't there. He's fallen over. Not only so, he's fallen flat on his face, verse 3, before the ark of the Lord. It's almost as if Dagon has been tempted to worship the new arrival. Still, they might say, well, perhaps it's a coincidence. Perhaps the mice got a bit busy and pushed him over. Perhaps the cleaner pushed him over and forgot to tell us. And if Dagon had been able to talk, the conversation might have gone something like this. Hello, Dagon. Do you have a good night? Not really, says Dagon. I fell over, actually. I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, can't you even get up? Let's lend you a hand. And so verse 3, that's exactly what they do. They take Dagon and they put him back in his place. Isn't that a wonderful picture of the powerlessness of this creature? Pagan religion always assumes that God is a bit feeble and needs a helping hand. And here they say, oh dear, poor old Dagon, let's pick him up and put him back. He can't possibly get there of his own efforts. Pagan religion always assumes that God is feeble and needs a helping hand. We know the story of the flood from the book of Genesis. The Babylonians had also had a story about a flood, but it's very differently told there. In the Babylonian version of the flood story, the gods get hungry because there's a flood and nobody's giving them any sacrifice. They can't have anything to eat. And they get more hungry. By the time the waters subside, the gods up there are absolutely ravenous. And a nice chap called Utnapishtim makes a sacrifice and the gods all hurry in and say, oh, at last, a nice meal for us. That's paganism. And it's here in Dagon. But the God of the Bible needs no one's help. He does what he chooses to do, and no one can tell him otherwise. He doesn't need a helping hand. Now, you and I are the ones who need the helping hand. Sometimes people are hesitant to begin the Christian life, to live from now on for Jesus Christ. They feel like I can't keep it up. But that is true. But he is there to keep you up. If there's any carrying to be done, he is the one who will be carrying you. But Dagon is very different. He has to be put back on his shelf. So they put him there and they retire for the second night. But on the second morning, in they come again. It is very, very plain that the first falling wasn't a coincidence. It wasn't an accident. This time, not only is he face down on the floor, but his head's been chopped off. And his hands as well. He is utterly powerless and in awe of the new arrival. And at this point, the defeated God of Israel is seen, in fact, to be victorious on the other guy's turf. And that causes panic in Philistia, and the panic spreads. No longer wanting the ark in Dagon's house, they wonder what to do with it. Dagon's house is in Ashdod. The men of Ashdod begin to suffer terrible symptoms. Verse 6, over the page we discover that. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors. And so they say, oh, we don't want this ark anymore. Send it off to Gath. It arrives in Gath. The people of Gath say, no, take it away. Young and old getting ill as soon as it arrives. They send it off to Ekron. Ekron said, what are you doing sending this here, making us all ill? It's a bit like a game past the parcel gone wrong, isn't it? Can't move it on fast enough. And it would be funny if it wasn't so serious, because they're discovering in their own way what Israel had forgotten, namely the fear of the Lord, that the God of Israel is not to be trifled with, and it's a superb picture of his sovereign freedom. They may think they have captured him, but it is not so. And that freedom we've seen exercised actually even in the death of Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli. God had said in chapter 2 that he would put them to death for their iniquity, and it's the Philistines who carry out God's sentence when Hophni and Phinehas die on the field of battle. You see, what God says goes every time. The elders did right to ask why the Lord had defeated them. They just didn't wait for an answer. But this God is free to do whatever he pleases. He serves no one. It's wonderful to know, isn't it, that God does whatever he pleases. That's a wonderful thing to know if you belong to him and if you know his absolute goodness and his mercy and his grace to us, that he is sovereign and free. If you don't yet belong to him and know his Father through the Lord Jesus Christ, then that sovereign freedom may seem more of a threat. But to the believer it is a precious truth that God is in the heavens and he does whatever he pleases, and therefore we can trust him at all times, when the clouds are gathering and are dark on the horizon, as much as when the sky is blue and the sun is shining brightly. I remember a few years ago going up St. John's Road to the old Kent and Sussex Hospital, where one of our church family had been taken in an emergency. Some of us will remember Mary Mullins. It's a few years ago. Mary's condition was suddenly very serious. I think it was even life-threatening. When I arrived, she was on one of those mobile hospital beds, you know, waiting for the next thing to be happened, to be wheeled off to whoever was going to deal with the issue. This was on a Tuesday morning, I think. She'd been suddenly rushed in an ambulance. When I arrived, she looked up and saw me, and before I could say anything, she said, "Oh, Charles, I'm so sorry I haven't written to thank you for that lovely lunch we had on Sunday." And to be honest, it wasn't a great concern of mine, but it clearly was of hers. She knew that the sovereign God was on her side. She could trust him at all times. Her concern was whether she'd said thank you for lunch 2 days previously. It is a wonderful thing to know that our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases, and he can be trusted at all times. The great preacher Charles Spurgeon in the 19th century put it like this: "It is impossible that any ill should happen to the one who is beloved of the Lord. Ill to him is no ill, but only good in a mysterious form. Losses enrich him. Sickness is his medicine. Reproach is his honor. Death is his gain." The battle may be lost, the ark may be lost, but God's cause is never lost. He remains triumphant to the end. It was a dark day, wasn't it, for the Israelites when the Philistines defeated them in battle twice over. How their faces must have turned grey as they watched that precious box disappearing over the horizon in enemy hands. But how much darker a day it must have been for the disciples of Jesus, when not a box, but their beloved master was taken away and betrayed into the hands of his enemies and then nailed to a wooden cross. If ever a situation looked like one of defeat and disaster, it was surely that one. But it wasn't long before they discovered, of course, that at that very place where human hands had done their worst, God had played his masterstroke for the salvation of the world. His cause is never lost. And our times are in his hands. These are difficult days, aren't they, in our nation and the whole Western world. The visible church looks so pathetic and feeble. Christian people are increasingly marginalized in public life. The Christian undergirding of our laws and values is crumbling away at an alarming speed. But God isn't alarmed. He knows what he's doing. And as surely as Dagon bowed before the ark, so we may be sure that every knee will one day bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. We may be sure of that as we follow him today. And the false gods of today have no more power than Dagon to resist his will or to frustrate his purpose for our world.